taking the risk that at the time of death we may think of them and consequently take birth in a family of cats or dogs. Dayam Vishnu Pad Brahman Subhadra Dakitar Vasatar Satasisi Manasalange Sesi Bhakti Vinanta Samadhi Bhubhadi Vijay Ananta Koti Vaishnavindi Kijay. His confounded charge to the Prabhupada.
Our class is at Kookaburra time.
Yes? Janatimanandasya, Janardana Salakaya, Chaksasamidatam, Jaina Tasmat, Sri Gurvenama, Sri Chaitanya Manavistam, Stapitam, Jaina Bhutale, Sayam Rupakadamayam, Dagati Sapanatika. We've heard the six verses about Mahaprabhu, of, written by Krishnadas Kaviraj. And here we begin the seventh. We'll read these verses 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. That Nityananda Prabhu will read those again, and then we'll hear Prabhupada's words on the 12th verse and 13th is about Advaita Acharya, and the 14th is about the Panchatattva, and then 15 to 31 is just obeisances to worthy personalities, and then Kaviraj Goswami himself will begin to describe the first two verses, and that will go to the end of the first chapter. So here are the 7th through 11th verses, five verses. The first, as if you remember, is the first of these five. The 7th verse is a summary. And the next four verses can be extracted out of the 7th verse. May Sri Nityananda Ram be the object of my constant remembrance. And this we shall hear later, especially why Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, why he is speaking like that. Just do it all at once, please. Later on we'll hear how because Kaviraj Goswami was... he chastised his brother who disrespected Nityananda Prabhu, and then that night he had a dream, and Nityananda appeared to him in that dream, looking very, very wonderful, and he told him to go to Vrindavan, and there Nityananda Prabhu said, "You will achieve all things." So he considered himself, Kaviraj Goswami considered himself the disciple of Nityananda Prabhu. So may Sri Nityananda Ram be the object of my constant remembrance. Lord Balaram was given the name of Ram by Gauga Muni so many thousands of years ago. So Nityananda, who is no different from Balaram, is called Nityananda Ram. So may Sri Nityananda Ram be the object of my constant remembrance. Why would someone constantly remember another? In the 7th canto of the Bhagavatam, it describes that remembrance can be caused by anger or fear. But here, Kaviraj Goswami's remembrance is caused by great gratitude and love for Nityananda. Now, who is this Nityananda? Sankarsan, Seshanaga, it's two, and the Vishnus who lie on the Karna ocean, Garbhadak ocean, an ocean of milk, are his plenary portions and the portions of his plenary portions. So there's one, two, three, four, five Vishnus that are described in this verse, Seshanaga and Sankarsan. And those three Vishnus, Karna Daksha Vishnu, Garbha Daksha Vishnu, and Chira Daksha Vishnu, they are all called Supersouls. They are Paramatmas, Paramatma of the entirety of the material creation, Paramatma of the universe, and Paramatma of every living entity. The eighth verse. I surrender unto the lotus feet of Nityananda Ram, who is known as Sankarsan in the midst of the Chaturvyuha, consisting of Vasudev, Sankarsan, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. He possesses full opulence and resides in Vaikuntha Loka, far beyond the material creation. So that verse is a discussion of Sankarsan, who is an expansion, or he is, that Nityananda has become Sankarsan, because that's Balaram has also become Sankarsan. So this will be described later. Also in by Kaviraj Goswami, these verses will be explained in different chapters. And the next one, so that was Sankarsan. I offer my full obeisances unto the feet of Nityananda, Sri Nityananda Ram, whose partial representation called Karana Daksha Vishnu, lying on the Karana ocean, is the original Purusha, the master of the illusory energy and the shelter of all the universes. I offer my full obeisances unto the feet of Sri Nityananda Ram, a partial part of whom is Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. From the navel of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu sprouts the lotus that is the birthplace of Brahma, the engineer of the universe. The stem of that lotus is the resting place of the multitudes of planets. That's the second of the Vishnus. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the feet of Sri Nityananda Ram, whose secondary part is the Vishnu lying on the ocean of milk, Chiradakshay Vishnu. Amsa, Amsa, Amsa. So that's the verse. Yasya Amsa, Amsa, Amsa. Because an Amsa means a part. So a part of a part of a part. He is the Supersoul. He is the Ishwara, who is in everyone's heart, Ishvara Sarvabhutanam. He is the Paratma, the Supersoul, Akhilatma, of all living entities, Poshta, the maintainer, Vishnu. So he appears in the ocean of milk. His secondary part is the Vishnu lying in the ocean of milk. The Chiradaksha Vishnu is the Supersoul of all living entities and the maintainer of all the universes. Seshanaga is his further subpart. So that covers the five different tattvas that Kaviraj Goswami mentioned in the seventh verse as expansions of Nityananda. And the 12th and 13th verse, again, we'll talk about Advaita Charya and we'll discuss those. So, Prabhupada explains this. Now, Radha and Krishna are hard to explain, but also is Nityananda. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu can only be explained in relationship to Radha and Krishna. Nityananda will be explained in relationship to Nityananda Ram, Balaram, but also in relationship to the universes. And out of these five expansions and parts and parts and parts of Nityananda Ram, listen to what they are. First is Lord Sankarsan, who lives in the Vaikuntha planets. So imagine how difficult it was for Prabhupada to explain this. The Vaikuntha planets, what are Vaikuntha planets? Those places, the spiritual world where there is no anxiety. And what does, there are unlimited Vaikuntha planets, the top one being Goloka Vrindavan, spiritual planets. And on this planet, the predominating deity has forearms, not forearms like that, and but forearms, he has forearms like that, and he's eternal, living there, and an expansion of him also has forearms, Karna Daksha Vishnu, and this is explained in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, in the third chapter, the beginning of the third chapter, that Karna Daksha Vishnu, from he's lying down on the Karna ocean. Karna means cause. So this ocean is the cause of all the material manifestation. And universes, he has forearms too. And universes are coming from his breathing. And those universes sit like foam upon the causal ocean. And then he expands further, the Karna Daksha Vishnu, into each and every universe. So there's not one universe, there's unlimited universes, like seeds of mustard in a big bag, or like clusters of foam on top of the ocean. And that Karna Daksha Vishnu expands into each of those universes, and he is known as Garbha Daksha Vishnu. Garbha means womb. So he expands into the womb of the material universe, and he lies down. He fills up all the... This is explained, if you look at the cover of the first canto of the Bhagavatam, on the insert, the inner flap, Prabhupada explains this, because the pictures show this. The picture on the cover, this was Prabhupada's presentation of the first canto of the Bhagavatam. That Karna Daksha Vishnu expands into Garbha Daksha Vishnu, unlimited Garbha Daksha Vishnu is practically speaking, and enter each one of every of the universes, and then from his navel, Garbha Daksha Vishnu grows. There's a lotus that comes out of his navel. This is quite astounding. And on that lotus, in the stems are all the stem of the lotus, which is astounding enough, all the planets in the universe. And on top of that lotus, when it blossoms, Lord Brahma takes his birth, and he's the secondary creator of the universe. He creates what has already been created in the Sarga creation. Krishna creates through his potencies in the Garbha Daksha Vishnu potency. He creates the elements, and through his glance, and everything is created. This is described in the third canto of the Bhagavatam. Everything is created, and then Brahma assembles them. So he is a secondary creator, the Vishag creator. He creates that which has all been created after looking at the blueprint, the documentation for the universe. And then, if that isn't enough, he expands again. So an Anksha, Anksha, Anksha is Kira Daksha Vishnu. And he maintains the universes through his potency by being in every living entity's heart, in every atom, between every atom. So he's all pervading. So when we say that God is everywhere, this is how he is everywhere. Kira Daksha Vishnu. And it is the business or the goal of a yogi to perceive that super soul in everyone's heart. And Seshanaga, who is he's a snake, unlimited hooded snake, and he's holding up all the universes upon the hoods, because he has many heads. So now, how is he going to explain this? Of course, in the 60s, people would have thought it was, you know, this is really far out. This is quite astounding. Let's see how Prabhupada explains these very amazing points. After offering obeisances to Lord Chaitanya, Krishnadas Kaviraj begins offering them to Lord Nityananda in the seventh verse of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. The author explains that Lord Nityananda is Balaram, who is the origin of Mahavishnu. Krishna's first expansion is Balaram, a portion of whom is manifest as Shankarshan, who then expands as Prajumna. In this way, so many expansions take place. Although there are many expansions, Lord Krishna is the origin, as confirmed in the Brahma Samhita. He is like the original candle from which many thousands and millions of candles are lit. Although any number of candles can be lit, the original candle still retained its identity as the origin. In this way, Krishna expands himself into so many forms, and all these expansions are called Vishnu Tattva. Vishnu is a large light, and we are all small lights, but all are expansions of Krishna. So everything is coming from Krishna. Here is the first point that Prabhupada is making. And it's just as one candle can be lit from another candle, and that second candle may have, we can say, the same potency as the original candle, and then a third from the second candle, and a fourth from the third candle, they all may have the same potency in giving off light, but yet there is an origin to all. And in the case of Krishna and all his expansions, including Balaram, the difference between them is very, very slight, because they are Vishnu Tattva. Krishna can expand unlimitedly and not lose any of his potency, his power, his ability, his strength. And the example again is the candles. But yet, the original candle is the original candle. So, and then Prabhupada explains, Krishna expands himself into so many forms, and all these expansions are called Vishnu Tattva. Vishnu is a large light, and we are small light. So we are binanangsa, means separated parts and parcels. Everything is expanding from Krishna, but we are not in the category of Vishnu. We are tiny expansions of Krishna, like sparks from the fire. And just as a spark cannot maintain its own light, it has to be within the fire to maintain its light. Or if it falls on flammable grass of some dry grass or something like some straw, then it can ignite that. So that is compared to it, the spark falling, or the soul being in the mode of goodness. And then if it falls in the on the telephone, then it will be extinguished. Now if it falls on rocky ground or wet ground, it will be extinguished. That's like ignorance. So when it is necessary, so that's the living entity, where he falls, and how he does depends on the modes of material nature that he acquires. So therefore, for the best result, one should try to cultivate the mode of goodness. There are different things that one can do in this world to cultivate the different modes of material nature. One can engage in different activities, and one does indeed have freedom in this regard. We have freedom to eat different types of food, to drink different types of water, to engage in different types of activities, and these activities deeply affect our consciousness, they contract or allow our consciousness to expand. The mode of ignorance contracts the consciousness. It makes it dull. The mode of goodness expands the consciousness and allows it to proceed in spiritual life. It is less restricting. So that is the jivas, the conditioned souls. But the Vishnu Tattva expansions of the Lord, different from the Jiva Tattva expansions of the Lord, they are powerful. They cannot come under the control of the modes of nature. So why does Krishna expand? Or why, we can say, why does Balaram expand into Sankarsan, and then Mahavishnu, Karnadaksha Vishnu, etc. And the reason Prabhupada will explain here, because the reason why he expands into Balaram is, if we want to talk in causally, is for the pleasure of his pastimes. And the reason he expands further, Balaram expands further, will be explained now. When it is necessary to create the material universes, Vishnu expands himself as Mahavishnu. Mahavishnu lies down in the causal ocean and breathes all the universes from his nostrils. Thus from Mahavishnu and the causal ocean spring all the universes, and all these universes, including ours, float in the causal ocean. In this regard, there is a story of Vamana. What canto? Is the story of Vamandev described? Eighth canto of the Bhagavad Gita. Vamanadev. So, okay, Prabhupada's already explained these expansions to create the universe, and universes are floating in the causal ocean. There's a story of Vamanadev who, when he took three steps within a universe, he stuck his foot through the covering of this universe, and water from the causal ocean flowed through the hole that his foot made. And it is said that that water became the river Ganges. Therefore, the Ganges is accepted as the most sacred water of Vishnu, and is worshipped by all Hindus, from the Himalayas down to the Bay of Bengal. Did you bathe in the Ganga, Linda? Yes. Does it feel like bathing in the Indian Ocean over here in Perth? Did you notice a difference? I remember that was my one of my great fears when I first went to India for the first time. What if I go to the Ganga and bathe and it feels just like bathing in the ocean or something like that? What's going to happen? But I thought, wait a second, when I did bathe, I thought it was quite purifying. It was quite a different experience. Remember that time that when the first time we went to Vrindavan with Jagarupad, and we brought him to the Yamuna, and he swam in the Yamuna, and he came back chanting and chanting and chanting. He wouldn't stop chanting. Do you remember that? Maybe we should try that one again. Well, three. It was three when he went to Vrindavan. These rivers are so purifying, so powerful, so purifying. Therefore, the great teachers who have a full realization of their potency, they write prayers to the Yamuna, to the Ganga. So the Ganga is holy because it comes from being pierced by the toe of Vamandev as he stepped through the universe, pierced in that way. And that river that is out of the universe, not river, but the causal ocean, some of that came through. And that's the Ganga. There are other stories of how the Ganga and the came about, and that's described in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam. And it's quite astounding that if you put water, just ordinary old water, in a container and you leave it for some time, you taste it and it tastes terrible and it grows all kinds of things in it. But if you take Ganga water and carry it somewhere, you can leave it for I don't know how long, but you can leave it and 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 leave it, and it remains pure, and you can just drink it, and it's quite incredible. And therefore the when they were part of the in the Hindu culture, they were, because water, and this is also described in the Bhagavatam in the 11th canto, it says that the water that you drink affects your consciousness. It's one of the main effectors of the consciousness. So the very, very strict Hindus, they're very careful about what kind of water they drink. And there's I once met an elderly Brahmin lady who, she wouldn't drink water, she would only drink water that came from a river. She would never drink water that came from under the ground. I don't know what the exact reasoning was, but I can imagine that the river water, because it's flowing, it's pure, considered more pure than groundwater. Who knows what's going into it, etc. So in any case, when the kings, there's a king in Jaipur who, he was going to England, probably to play polo or something like that. But he was going to England, but he wouldn't drink, he decided not to drink any of the water in England or on the way. Now what was he going to do? So he had these huge, huge silver pots made. I can't remember how big they are, but one of them they still have, but they're huge. Not a pot, but a flask with a thing with a top. I don't remember if it had spigots or something, how to get the water out. But that wasn't a problem because you have hundreds of servants.
Like about this wide,
silver, and then they when he went to England, he filled them with Ganga water.
Even on the boat.
Yeah. Because Ganga water doesn't go bad. Because it's spiritual. And there was a time in India, I don't remember how many years ago, but instead of getting Bisleri water or something like that, you could buy packets of Ganga water, packets or bottles of Ganga water, and it really tasted something else. Something wonderful, quite wonderful. So Mahavishnu is actually an expansion of Balaram, who is Krishna's first expansion, in the Vrindavan pastimes, his brother. In the Mahamantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, the word Rama refers to Balaram. Since Lord Nityananda is Balaram, Rama also refers to Lord Nityananda. Thus, Hare Krishna, Hari Rama addresses not only Krishna Balaram, but Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda as well. And it also addresses Lord Rama can mean Lord Ramachandra, Rama and Hare Krishna, and it also can mean Krishna, Radhika Raman. It can mean the giver of pleasure. But we don't argue about these things. Some people want to perceive Lord Ramachandra in the Mahamantra and pray to him in that way and worship him. Some want to worship Lord Balaram, and some want to just hear Krishna's, Rama is the name of Krishna. The subject matter of the Chaitanya Charitamrita primarily deals with what is beyond the material creation. The cosmic material expansion is called Maya, illusion, because it has no eternal existence. Because it is sometimes manifested and sometimes not, it is regarded as illusory. But beyond this temporary manifestation is a higher nature, as indicated in the Bhagavad Gita. So here Prabhupada is saying we're not going to discuss the details of the creation or the material manifestation. Because the subject matter of Chaitanya Charitamrita deals with the spiritual world, the material world is temporary. It's sometimes manifest, it's sometimes unmanifest, it's always shifting, it's changing. But the spiritual world, which is the natural position for the eternal soul, is itself eternal. It is a higher nature, and it is beyond the temporary material nature, and Prabhupada's quoting Bhagavad Gita 8:20. Parastasmat tu bhavo anyo vyakta vyakta sanatana yasa saveshu bhuteshu nasyatsu na vinashyati.
Yet there is another unmanifested nature, Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, which is eternal and is transcendental to this manifested and unmanifested matter. It is supreme and is never annihilated. When all in this world is annihilated, that part remains as it is. The material world has a manifested state, vyakta, and a potential unmanifested state, avyakta. So it exists. The material world always exists, but sometimes it's manifested or sometimes it's in its potential form, unmanifested. The supreme nature is beyond both the manifested and the unmanifested material nature. This superior nature can be understood as the living force which is present in the bodies of all living creatures. The body itself is composed of inferior nature, matter, but it is the superior nature that is moving the body. So here is the difference between the spiritual nature and the material nature. The spiritual nature has a potency, has consciousness, and it moves the material body, which is made out of matter. Clearly, the material body is made out of matter. The material scientists claim that's all there is just matter. But what was the answer that Prabhupada loved to that point, when they say that it is just matter, just chemicals? Yes. If we supply you chemicals, can you do it? Can you make life? If life comes from matter, we'll provide you whatever chemicals you want. Can you do it? Are you able to substantiate your claim? Prabhupada really was pleased with that. So in the future we'll be able to do it. And then Prabhupada called that a post-dated blank check. I'll give you a check for whatever you want. Did anyone ever fall for one of those post-dated checks? Did anyone ever? I've had my experience in that years and years ago. People give you post-dated checks. You must have had your share of post-dated checks that suddenly disappeared when they were suddenly canceled. They're not worth anything.
One day for next week, one day for the week after, one day for the week after.
Yeah. And often, or sometimes, they were bad. Yeah. Sometimes. So, someone says to you, we'll give you a post-dated check for any amount, you can fill in the amount. So, an inexperienced person will feel elated as he dreams and enthusiastically of what he's going to do with all the money that he's going to withdraw. But it's post-dated. It'll come later. Yes, 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 it will come later. But the post-dated blank check never has any value. So something now. That was probably, give us something now, Prabhupada would say. At least produce one tiny mosquito. Give us something now, and then we'll trust your words. No post-dated blank check. And he said that our experience isn't that life comes from matter, that life, the living force, is produced from chemicals, but the opposite, that chemicals come from life. And what was the example that he gave in that book, Life Comes from Life? I remember? No? A lemon tree. That's so much of the chemical of citric acid is produced by something that's alive. The tree is alive. And there are hundreds and hundreds of lemons come out of the lemon tree. It's alive. How many lemons come out of a dead tree? None. But out of the live tree come so many lemons, and the lemons have so much citric acid, so our experience is that chemicals are produced from life, not life is produced from chemicals. So we see so many examples of chemicals coming from life, even bacteria, when they you put them in a certain situation and they produce so many chemicals. But we don't see the chemicals producing life. So why just assume it? Post-dated blank check. So it is the life, the soul, the spiritual energy that is moving the material body. It is giving life to the spiritual body, is producing consciousness within the material body. And that consciousness is constant. That sense of existence, of being, that sense of I am that everyone possesses, that is a product not of matter, but it is a symptom of the soul. So the symptom, the body itself is composed of inferior nature, matter, but it is the superior nature that is moving the body. The symptom of that superior nature is consciousness. Thus, in the spiritual world where everything is composed of the superior nature, everything is conscious. There are no material bodies to drag around in the spiritual world. Everything is conscious. People are their bodies. They say, Prabhu, you are your body, you know. That wasn't funny? Okay. There, a table, in the material world, there are inanimate objects that are not conscious. But in the spiritual world, nothing is inanimate. There, a table is conscious, the land is conscious, the trees are conscious, everything is conscious. It is not possible to imagine how far this material manifestation extends. In the material world, everything is calculated by imagination or by some imperfect method. But the Vedic literatures give real information of what lies beyond the material universe. Since it is not possible to obtain information of anything beyond this material nature by experimental means, those who believe only in experimental knowledge may doubt the Vedic conclusions, for such people cannot even calculate how far this universe extends, nor can they reach far into the universe itself. That which is beyond our power of conception is called achintya, inconceivable. It is useless to argue or speculate about the inconceivable. If something is truly inconceivable, it is not subject to speculation or experimentation. By definition, if it is inconceivable, it's inconceivable. And if something is inconceivable, nothing one can do can pierce it to the degree that one can conceive of it. Our energy is limited, and our sense perception is limited. Therefore, we must rely on Vedic conclusions regarding that subject matter which is inconceivable. Knowledge of the superior nature must simply be accepted without argument. How is it possible to argue about something to which we have no access? So this is how Prabhupada is explaining to his young students. Because these topics, we can explain them about Krishna, about Vrindavan, about Radha and Krishna's dealings. We can explain them to some degree with logic. But logic in and of itself will not ultimately convince anyone. It can push away one's doubts to some degree, but it doesn't give one the positive experience. That positive experience can only come from Krishna. So the Shastra, Prabhupada is explaining, is the access to the information of the spiritual world which is beyond our experience and is inconceivable. The method for understanding transcendental subject matter is given by Lord Krishna himself in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna tells Arjuna at the beginning of the fourth canto, Imam vivasvate yogam proktavana hamavyayam vivasvan manave praha manoriksa kave bravit. I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god, Vivaswan, and Vivaswan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed it to Ikshaku. This is the method of parampara, or disciplic succession. Similarly, Srimad Bhagavatam explains that Krishna imparted knowledge into the heart of Brahma, the first created being within the universe. Brahma imparted those lessons to his disciple Narada, and Narada imparted that knowledge to his disciple Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva imparted it to Madhvacharya, and from Madhvacharya the knowledge came down to Madhavendrapuri, and then to Ishwarapuri, and from him to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. One may ask that if Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna himself, then why did he need a spiritual master? But before one may ask that question, one may have other questions that one may want to ask about what Prabhupada was saying about the process of getting knowledge of that which is inconceivable. Anyone have any questions? Logic and analogy can make things seem plausible, and logic and analogy can show us how things that we accept as reality in this world, we just accept on our faith, basically. And they are not any more plausible, in fact, just like the point that life comes from matter and evolution. You can disprove the evolutionary theory in so many ways. It's completely improbable. It's not really logical. You prove that it takes complete faith to accept that life is generated from chemicals. But yet everyone believes these things. Blind followers. So logic can help crush our foolish belief systems. And it can make being the existence of the spiritual world, etc., equally as plausible as the foolish belief systems that we blindly accept. But it can't, in and of itself, ultimately prove it, nor give us the experience. It can make it appear reasonable. Why not? Why shouldn't you accept it? Something like that, but it can't in and of itself give one the positive knowledge. That takes faith in Shastra, and that faith can come, faith is a product as the Bhagavad Gita explains of the mode of goodness, of purity. And one of the Puranas, there's one verse that I've recently come across that explains that the reason why one doesn't have faith in things that are true is due to sinful coverings over the heart, sinful reactions. So all the skepticism that we are born with in Kali Yuga is the sinful reactions, according to Shastra. Questions, comments?
That same an explaining or proving Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, like we come across statements like that, like that we can't, like the statement that he's inconceivable and we can't understand the violence and our material senses, or these kind of statements which kind of protect that conclusion that Krishna is.
But that's obvious.
Yeah, and sex.
But it's obvious, isn't it? That you can't, I mean, not maybe that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead isn't obvious, but that if that one can't understand God with one's logic and argument, that's obvious.
But it seems that, like, in religion and science, people, like this kind of rules to the game, like, in religion, or, like, say, in Krishna consciousness, there's self-defined rules to the game, and similarly with science. So it's like based on like the same. We could apply the same thing to science and say, well, if someone just accepts dense matter, then the whole of creation and life can be explained. But it just depends on the acceptance of dense matter.
Which dense matter as?
It's an inconceivable thing that we can't.
Well, it's clearly that it's inconceivable ultimately, isn't it? Dense matter?
Pardon?
Isn't matter inconceivable too?
Yeah.
Scientists can't understand matter. And the more deeper they look, the more they just raise more questions. But that's not the point you were making. But yeah, so in other words, to accept what the scientists say, so we usually make the false dichotomy between religion means faith, science means logic and reason. But it's really faith versus faith, as opposed to faith versus reason. Because the scientists, how could you have faith in what they say? How can you, if it's science, true science, in that it's true fact, it is fact, it is irrefutable fact, then how come their theories continuously are changing? And that which is accepted previously is not accepted now. That which was accepted as ironclad gospel truth is not accepted now. And they say, yes, because we're learning more and more. So why should I accept with faith what you're saying now is truth? So it's faith versus faith, not faith versus reason. That's the point I wanted to make there. But yes, you need faith.
Then I can say it's not reason versus faith either.
Right, I agree. It's faith versus faith. That's what I'm saying. But it's not reason versus faith. It's faith versus faith. So we have to decide who's giving us. Who are we going to have faith in? Look at that's part of it there. So where are you getting the proper experiences from? For example, what has been the result? For example, of following that path, are the scientists happy sorts of fellows? For example. Yes. Do you want to be led by them and trust them? And then what we end up with is, I don't want to be like them. I don't want to trust them. I only trust myself, which obviously no one can just trust themselves. It's a very lonely world when one only trusts oneself. And what? Then what's going to be left of oneself at the time of death too? Which self do you trust? The one that we see when we look in the mirror when we're 20 years old? We have the same trust when that self has vanished? And you look in the mirror when you're 70 years old? Where is that self that you've trusted gone? Did that address your question partially?
No.
What was your question then?
It
You can think about it more and then you can ask it later, perhaps. No, it's very hard in Kali Yuga to have faith. There's so many reasons why not to have faith in Kali Yuga. But the alternative to trusting, the alternative being not trusting, not having faith, is also terrifying. And So ados shraddha, the beginning is faith. There is some trust, and that comes from some piety. So it's not that we are being told, on one level we are, Prabhupada, as the Acharya, he took that stance, that everyone must have faith. You know, you show me why you shouldn't have faith. He was very bold in his preaching like that. But from this point of view, we take our steps forward according to our faith, and we see the results. And then we take more steps forward and we trust more. We gather our transcendental experiences.
If you say that you can't assume Krishna consciousness at all, you kind of can't use your intelligence then.
Not you can't use your intelligence. The intelligence may be necessary, but it's not sufficient. Not you can't use your intelligence, but you shouldn't use your intelligence, but it's insufficient to come up with Krishna.
Right.
You can use your intelligence, but
I mean, I can't get there
by
my intelligence.
Yeah.
And
I'm
stuck.
Yeah, but what we do, and that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu helps us, I think, just generate this stuff. And it cleanses the heart. It has very positive effects. It cleanses the heart. It awards more faith by doing that. It gives us transcendental experiences. Shreya Karaiva Chandrika Vataranam Vidyavaram Jivanam. Shreya Karaiva Chandrika, the white lotus of our good fortune blossoms. It nourishes that too. So as one becomes purified, purification means removal of the coverings of the sinful reactions over the heart, and simultaneously one gains transcendental experience. Simultaneously, those two things go on. The heart is cleansed, and one gains those transcendental experiences. Then one proceeds further, maybe not to the ultimate point, and from my understanding, faith isn't something like you either have it or you don't have it. And it's not like ados shraddha means that you have faith and then after you have faith you go on to sadhusanga. No, your faith is always increasing. So as much as one can increase one's faith, obviously one's surrender increases. So one's surrender simultaneously goes on increasing. So because one doesn't have the fullest of faith doesn't mean one can't do anything. So one can act on the faith that one does have. And sometimes, what? What? Probably. It depends on what your faith is, what you do. It depends what your desires are, what you do. You know, you say if you have enough faith to take another step, then you do that. Some people just chant Hare Krishna, come to a temple once a week or once a month, and whatever they get, and they're satisfied with that. And other people go every week, and other people go every day, and some people take beads home, and some people chant for a while and find the effect wonderful, and they want to perform more devotional service, they want to give something. Some people want to give their lives, some people want to give their hearts, some people want to serve in this way, some people develop. It's not on or off. It's a progression. Desire for further, the faith also, it's a part of love too, because you can't love someone that you don't have faith in, for example. So as one's faith develops and one's relationship develops, you know, your desire may not be specifically for faith, but it may be for advancement or something like that. So all things are added, and one becomes more experienced. And then as one becomes more experienced, then one can give more of oneself. But we should also know at the time of death, and there is an element of the faith that is willing. You can will your faith too. It's not that it's all internal, has nothing to do with intelligence, that you can will your faith also. You know, I choose to have faith in something, even though I may not have that full faith. You choose it, and sometimes you have to make a decision whether am I an atheist or a theist? And you say, well, I decided what I'm going to take my chances with the theist.
So sometimes when the mind is really doubtful, you can say, well, let's just go with this and see if it works.
Yeah, you can do that. Or you can just take rest and wake up and see if you feel better. I mean, there's many ways to deal with it. Or you can just chant hard. Today I'm going to chant 150,000 rounds, or there's many ways to deal with it.
Also, that point you made, that as much as we're struggling for the required faith, we can identify that it's been a result of our past. Simple activity is important because rather than just being frustrated, one can identify that in the situation I'm in.
And then how one deals with that. There's two ways to deal with that. One is that's part of your closed logic system. The reason why I don't believe is because I'm sinful. Rather, the reason I don't believe that that's the reason why I don't believe. The reason I don't believe is because I see so many things that are inconsistent. You could say that. So you're just trying to say that to. So that's. And the Shastra says that's impious.
Yeah.
And then the question comes, how do you deal with your lack of faith? So one way to deal with it is using the guidance of that text, I'll try to make sure I don't act sinfully anymore, and add more coverings, and I'll purify my heart by acting properly. And another way to deal with it, perhaps that can go simultaneous with that, is just sort of not taking it so seriously.
Yeah,
you just say, well, this is my karma, that I'm, you know, I'm not faithful, but I won't let that affect how I'm, what I'm doing. That means your faith in certain things is more deeper. Some certain elements of Krishna consciousness is deeper than your mind's doubts, because doubting is, or intelligence is doubts. Doubting is a function of intelligence. So you may have so many transcendental experiences that you trust even more than the doubts that are born of your intelligence. So you choose to have faith in your transcendental experiences more than in your intelligence and its capacity to doubt.
That transcendental experience can come through the intelligence, right? Just as
How could transcendental experience can come through the intelligence?
Like reading Shastra and hearing the philosophy.
But the experience, but by definition, transcendental experience, oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah,
but what I'm saying is something different.
You're losing your intelligence.
Well,
so it's going to be like, well, this, my experience is that, not that I'm anything to go by, but that I've found what's been most grounding for me is my experiences within my intelligence, hearing about the philosophy.
But
my
I would.
Because my faith can
but
be influenced in so many ways.
But I would say, first of all, that there are different kinds of people, and the what you've heard, in other words, through your intelligence, I would say that that's proper to have one's intelligence fixed so that the mind doesn't become fooled, and one should study Shastra for that reason. But also, in hearing Shastra, you're getting more than something coming from just limiting itself by its results on the intellectual platform. There's also a spiritual experience in hearing Shastra, or there can be. That's very quite liberating.
The potentialities.
And what I would say is that it's not that that there would be no. See, the intelligence fixes you to something. No, I won't even say it. Yeah, so I think that's fine. The superior logic and reasonableness of it can fix one. But I would say that one has to have a certain piety to be able to do that, too, and a certain transcendental experience. Otherwise, there's sort of no reason to fix yourself.
So are we saying that the lack of faith to your impiety, and that can be reversed? Or is it like,
certainly,
here we are.
Well, that's Mahaprabhu's mercy, that you can just chant Hare Krishna. But then one could say that, and that removes impiety and it gives one a transcendental experience. But one could say that because of my impiety I can't chant Hare Krishna. So if one doesn't have that type of sukriti, then indeed one can't chant Hare Krishna, but gradually one can accumulate it by good fortune or by the grace of God. And everyone seems to have, and different people seem to have their own times. And when we look at our struggles in this life, you know, like that, and then we see there are maybe perhaps devotees who are very extremely pure and very advanced, and everything seems so easy and natural. But that just means that they had their struggles, the ones that we're having, it could be 100 lives ago or 200 lives ago, perhaps. So therefore there's no loss or diminution on the path. So we should fight the noble fight and understand what else is really worth striving for in this life, struggling for. Should we struggle for the temporary? But we have a little bit of intelligence, not even very much. We understand what's going to happen to everything we gain on the material level, up to the more subtle points of that, our fame. How, you know, whose fame survives more than a few years? Or you could say a few hundred years. Or the people whose fame survives the longest are the spiritual people, in any case. So what's the use of striving for something on this gross material level? So I might as well fight the noble fight and do the best I can with in this life.
There's a verse, is there not, in the first canto that talks about how by serving the Bhagavat, great service is done, and then one gets an affinity for hearing the Bhagavat?
Shushusho, Sharadana, Seva, Vasudeva, Tarun, see that one?
That's the fresh Bhagavat, you chant Bhagavat, say
that. But that, this is mixing the two verses, I think.
Yeah.
The affinity for hearing is the one I said, and
yeah.
The serving the Bhagavat. Is the other one.
So is it possible that even if you don't have faith and you have some intelligence, through your intelligence you can, and the logic, you're just saying you can't be convinced by the logic, but maybe if you're...
No, I didn't say you can't be convinced by the life. I said that you can't understand the absolute truth to the fullest extent through logic. After all, through logic, how are you going to understand that God is playing his flute on a on top of a hill that we're not allowed to walk on, and he has a peacock feather in his hair? How are you going to understand that through an ascending process of logic?
Because we're talking about logic, you, or intelligence used in connection with hearing Shastra. We're not talking about intelligence used.
Now it's getting confused already. You know, we're just at different points of the conversation. We were saying different things. So why don't you just say the point that you want to say instead of referring to something. Ask the question you want to ask instead of referring to.
And you don't have very much faith. You have some intelligence and you're hearing these things. And you want to sort of keep them like in your range of acceptance, whatever. That by serving in different ways, in other words, using the other faculties that you have, it seems like the Bhagavatam is saying there that through that service you can get to the point where your faith is sufficient to actually get taste of hearing about Krishna.
Yeah, sure.
Rather than just only intellectually.
Sure. But understand that there is already some faith in the heart, because there are hundreds and thousands and millions of people who are intellectually based, and how many of them have an inclination to hear the Bhagavatam, for example, to approach Krishna through their intelligence? Not so many. So therefore there's something in there, some sukriti. It's already there, otherwise one would have taken another path. I'm talking about a fully materialistic path. So just because one doesn't have, that's what I was also made that point, that it's not, faith isn't like a light that's either on or off. Yeah, I made that point that faith, like love, something that grows, like devotion, like, yeah. It's not the beginning, a stage that you, okay, I got my faith, now what's the next thing? No, it's nested, it's always, it's the essential part of bhakti, it's the seed.
Does that mean that the different levels that you hear about are, relation to the development of the thing?
You can, because if it's a seed, you can say that. Because it's always there. You, by the time you're at Ruchi, for example, your faith is so much greater than it was when you're just starting your sadhu sangha.
I mean, when we first met devotees, we're putting into our terms rather than into the classical terms. When we first meet devotees, you have a little faith when you first meet devotees. And then if you examine where you are, by the time you have a taste and flavour of the chanting, you can see that it's...
Because you have so much more, your faith has grown. But that's not the end, it will still go further. One say when you have a direct experience of Krishna, Sakshat Darshan, then your faith is still greater. And that's a bhava or prema. Faith is always there, it's always growing. And your surrender is always growing, and your taste is always growing, and your attraction is always, attachment is always growing. Where did we end here?
In confusion.
Not all of us ended in confusion. What where did we end in the
last thing we read was one may ask if Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna.
Yes, okay.
Why did he need a solution?
Yeah. So we stopped there because of so but we don't want to end in confusion, we want to end in more certainty. So what's the question that you have? What's the point of confusion?
So one is that one can, this may only be gone and most likely going on false premises, but if one can understand Krishna fully through, like realize Krishna fully through deity worship or hearing chanting, then why can't one realize Krishna fully through the intelligence? Because it seems that when Krishna's supreme in all respects, so he's may I think, well, he should be, he is supremely logical as well. Everything is the supreme logic, the one.
But your logic, if the logic is applied to Shastra, then the primary thing, how that fits in it, is through the Shastra, through Srimad Bhagavatam. So there are five inherently powerful processes. Deity worship is one. Because Krishna is personally present in that. The holy names are another. Krishna is actually present in that. But Krishna isn't present personally in intelligence. But if the intelligence is applied to Shastra, he's present in the Shastra, personally in the Bhagavatam. So it's taking the, you can also apply your intelligence to deity worship. You could also apply your intelligence to continuously thinking how to spread Krishna's glories, the kirtan in that sense. But intelligence in and of itself isn't inherently Krishna.
But Krishna can reveal himself through the intelligence.
He won't do that. He won't do that unless, because there's no devotion in intelligence. There has to be devotion. So the through intelligence, he'll reveal his Brahman feature. You can actually achieve that through your intelligence. Almost, not quite. Intelligence in and of itself doesn't have devotion. You might be through hearing. Krishna is not, it's part of, it's his energy, but he's not in the terms of other shastras. The sarup siddhi forms of bhakti that are directly Krishna. They're directly Krishna. Intelligence isn't directly Krishna. It's a material element. But the Bhagavatam is directly Krishna. The holy names are directly Krishna. Intelligence is a material energy, just like wood. If you just put your intelligence, if you just study wood, you won't find Krishna in there. Yes. But what then? That confirms just what I was saying.
that the ear is material, but there's a sound that comes. In the analogy that you're saying, the ear is material, so how could you use the ear to find God? But the sound vibration that enters the ear is the thing that has the spiritual potency. So similarly, the intelligence compared to the ear is material, to the eardrum in the analogy that you just gave. So if you apply your intelligence to the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu through Shastra, you'll find that you'll actually get there. But intelligence in and of itself is like the eardrum. It's material. It's a material element. But there's something that has to descend.
So one can fully realize Krishna through the intelligence.
If, but not without bhakti, though.
With bhakti.
And these, you have to, if you should devote your intelligence to Krishna.
Dedicated
intelligence. And then it will serve to surrender, to learning how to surrender.
But there are those who apply their intelligence to Krishna and don't become Krishna conscious. People who study scholars, they don't become Krishna conscious.
Because there's the absence of bhakti.
Well, Krishna has to reveal himself.
Yeah,
it's
and that's what...
Freedom, yeah.
And then what makes Krishna inclined to do that? It's the bhakti. You have to get in touch with bhakti, devotion. Is that encouraging or discouraging?
Discouraging.
You don't want to be devoted? Then why is it discouraging? To be devoted? But humility is the first part of devotion. And that sounds like it's within your ability because you just said it. So you just admitted the limitations of intelligence. It's beyond, devotion is beyond our ability. But when Krishna offers it in one form or another, we should take it according to our capacity. To do everything is outside of our ability. To digest food is, to eat, to grow food is beyond our ability. You think scientists can grow food? They're just taking what Krishna has given them.
It's a way of seeing.
Zartini. Because you might just take it a little different when you deal directly. Because then I'll eventually have to come back. And then it's also late. We're completely dependent on Krishna. The air. Are you conscious? Are you breathing by your intelligence?
Subconsciously,
which means no. That's just a tricky way of saying no. You're not breathing by your intelligence. Nor are you digesting your food by your intelligence. Nor is your blood circulating in your body by your intelligence. And nor does your intelligence work independently of Krishna's mercy, or it's dependent on others, because you'll see when you get older your ability to intelligence that we gain our pride from is taken away. Memory is dependent on Krishna. So the problem with intelligence, of course, is it tends to make one arrogant. We think I'm doing it by my power, by my intelligence. Same thing with money. Money gives the most arrogance. Even more than intelligence or beauty or those things. Money gives the greatest of arrogance. But in 1 second, half of a second, Krishna can take away one's money, one's beauty, one's strength, one's intelligence. So when we realize or accept that we can't do everything by our own power, that we need things descending, we need some mercy, then we're at the door of devotion. want to do everything by our own power. But an old man is not proud, because everything that he identified as his has been taken from him by time. Time brings humility to everyone. Either that or bitter anger. If we don't become humble, we become bitterly angry. This is a lesson in reality. Surrender is mandatory, unavoidable. Someone, as Prabhupada is quoting Prabhupada, someone who says that they are free, it does not speak well for their sanity. I can do whatever I want. Well, stop becoming 19. I dare you. And then 20. And then 21. And then 50. And then 70. Stop the body from becoming old. That's only one example. There are hundreds of other examples of things that are so far out of our control. So Krishna is the controller of all those things. So what to speak of them being out of our control? Just imagine how out of our control he is. He's the one who is independent. Everyone else is dependent. So is that encouraging or discouraging? Is that encouraging or discouraging? Oh, but you should think that Krishna is very kind. And if he's very kind to you and merciful and he loves you, is that encouraging or discouraging? So probably all we need is a little more conviction that he's real, and that he's. That, I mean, and I'm not just saying you. I said we, meaning me too. That he's actually there and is kind and merciful, and he loves me. And if we trust that. And that he's all powerful. Because if he's kind and merciful and loves me, but he's not all powerful, that's it's not sufficient. It's not encouraging enough. But then one can actually lose all anxiety if one has that. And that's what Prabhupada said was the peace formula. Gyatvamam shantim rishati. So because we're not on that stage. If one is not resentful of that, but hopes that one can come to that stage one day, that is glorious. Is that encouraging or discouraging? Well, it's better than being discouraged anyway. It's turned off. Okay. Huh?